Interview with Mr. Terry Swan, 9 November 2009. Okay, so to begin, I'd just like you to give me a brief synopsis of your military career, just so we can situate your experiences in Cyprus.
Okay, so I was born in Saskatoon, joined the North Saskatchewan Regiment as a private, became a sergeant. 1967, switched over to ROTP at the University of Saskatchewan, graduated, went to the 2nd Canadian Guards in 69, got rebadged to 3rd Battalion Royal Canadian Regiment in 71, went to the Airborne Regiment in 73, deployed to Cyprus in 74, got out of the Army in 75, stayed in the reserve, went to law school, was with the North Saskatchewan Regiment, decided not to stay in Saskatoon. Moved to Victoria, joined the Canadian Scottish for a couple of years, and then switched over to Judge Advocate, and then retired as the Area Legal Advisor Pacific for the Reserve JAG.
Love it. Now, in your training as an officer, you were mentioning before that you didn't receive any real rules of engagement training, that was something that happened later with UN operations. Can you describe what kind of training you did receive in terms of when you were allowed to fire, when not?
I don't recall receiving any rules of engagement training, either as a cadet or even while I was with the battalion.
So your focus was, in terms of the Cold War, just on conventional warfare and fighting battles?
I think the focus was, mechanized operations and some dismounted operations, but based on a Northwest Europe approach. All our exercises were pretty much geared to NATO. The battalion I was with, we were tasked with NATO's northern flank, which is where the MFL battalion. And we had snowshoes, we were dismounted. But the issue of rules of engagement never really came up. We were more interested in the tactical approaches. And all our cadet training was, and our officer cadet training was, TOOTS, which is the tactical exercises without troops. But rules of engagement really never became an issue, to my recollection.
Alrighty. So when you went to Cyprus, you said that you had very little notice before you went. So I would assume from that that you did no real workup training for Cyprus?
We did zero workup training for Cyprus because we redeployed and then were sent to Cyprus within a matter of days from getting the warning order to the actual order to deploy. So we were in Edmonton, and we basically got our gear together, went down to the airport in Edmonton, flew to Germany, and then from Germany we landed at the RAF Dhekelia, I think it is, which is a British base, and got issued live ammo, and then you realized you were there.
Yes, of course. So in terms of the training that you had done for the Cold War, when you first arrived in Cyprus, did you find that that was pretty adequate to your needs?
Well, I think it probably was because with the line units, we were focused on the wars, that might come in Northwest Europe. But with the Airborne Regiment, you operated in much smaller groups. As opposed to platoon or company size, you operated more at section or one or two person level. So yeah, they were pretty able to operate independently at an OP.
So you find that operating independently in smaller groups was really more useful in terms of having the autonomy or the flexibility to react?
Well, that's what Cyprus was. It was a series of two or three person outposts, OPs, observation posts. And, it was usually platoon had four or five of them or three or four of them, and the company was responsible for a certain front. And you had to man those 24/7, so it was just a rota. Two on for 8 hours or 12 hours, two off, and the different posts. So the section commanders, who commanded usually 10, 12 soldiers, sort of look after their area. Our thing was resupplied with their own company, and the platoon commander made sure the weapons were sighted properly and that, they had the latest update for information and that, they basically were at a readiness level, whereas platoon sergeant made sure that all the stuff was resupplied, ammo, gear, water, food, and that the rotation was properly done.
So there was significant independence then, other than having those two people looking at you.
The soldiers were independent. He was often commanded by a corporal, or in some cases even a private. and they basically had a radio and a weapon and a little post with a bunch of sandbags around it, and they had to deal with things on their own.
Now, you shared with me the sort of rules of engagement, not really, but the CO's idea of what...
This was the instructions by the commander of Nicosia District.
The commander of Nicosia fire. District. And these are your rules for when you can fire. So you have to give a warning in Greek or Turkish, and you can... You're never allowed to place around in the chamber unless you intend to fire. Was this common on exercises or operations for the CO to give you a sort of list of general instructions like this?
No.
No? It was new.
It was new.
Was this, would you say this was sort of unique to UN operations?
I'd say that one was unique to UN operations because it was developed on the ground, you know, in response to the invasion. And I don't think there was probably very little input. Chances are that was done by, you know, the ops officer, who was probably a captain or maybe a major. Commander approved it, and that was what it did. It gave some security to the soldiers to know under what circumstance they could do things or not.
So the general reaction to these orders was positive. You'd find
definitely
perfect. So when you arrived in Cyprus, you said you arrived in July. Am I correct?
July.
So that was that before or after the invasion had started?
That was after the first phase of the Turkish invasion was done. And so we went over in response to the Turkish airborne invasion, because we had half the regiment there, and first commando was there. We were second commando. So when the Turkish invasion began, we went over in response to that.
Right. Could you just describe your first impressions and the sort of initial routine when you got there?
We got off the plane, landed at a British base, got issued live ammo, drove into Nicosia with buses and trucks. Got there, it was dark, it was almost been late at night. And first thing we did, we had an orders group by the commander of 2 Commando, who was a major. Told us what our areas of operations were. We sorted out the accommodation, and we never slept at all. And then the next morning, we deployed to the Green Line.
And you were, at the time, a platoon commander?
I was, at that time... I think I was a platoon commander. I might have been a company 2 IC, but I think I was a platoon commander.
So you were in charge directly of approximately 60, 70 people?
35.
All right. So did you feel once you got...
35 infantrymen.
35 infantry people.
Yeah, well,
infantrymen
troopers.
At that point.
It was all men, and we had no women in the regiment at that point.
Of course. So did you feel once you got settled in, did you find that you're adequately prepared? There wasn't any initial problems getting sorted out?
No, we were very prepared. I mean, we were able to work independently. I mean, I think the advantage of that was that we had our own area of operations. We had Canadian commanders. We had Canadian gear. We didn't rely on too much except for the Brits. The Brits provided us with a lot of the food because they had big kitchens. But the Brits and the Canadians were used to working together. So we were very self-sufficient. And I think everybody felt quite comfortable. In fact, they were quite keen to be there because it was changed from the sort of garrison routine.
So since... First Commando was there before you. Do you know if their sort of mandate changed drastically between when the invasion occurred and afterwards?
But I don't know, but there's probably some good resource material in the documents, which I have.
Perfect. Do you remember adapting, having any difficulties adapting to the new firing orders in Cyprus, the new sort of...
No, because nobody hardly ever used them.
No.
Because, you know, it wasn't like a firefight situation. We got there, we had deployed on the Green Line. A terrible thing we had to do was actually move a lot of dead bodies. And that was sort of the sergeant major's job. And, you know, the soldiers would load them on the trucks and then reestablish. Basically, what the Canadians wanted to do was establish communication with the local Greek and Turk commanders. So, you know, the officers would meet with the Turks and the Greeks, usually on the Green Line or just in their side, and introduce ourselves, tell them we were there, tell them what our mandate was, which, you know, no fighting. And so to a great extent was a PR battle. And there was always shooting at night, but 99% of that was Greeks taking shots at Turks and Turks taking shots at Greeks across the Green Line. So really, what can you do? You just report that. So you get these reports from the OP that there's, you know, five shots fired from grid reference such and such to the south, and the fire was returned. But pretty much it. It's more of a reporting issue at that point.
So primarily observers at that point.
I think observers and a deterrent. Like, I think more than just straight observation, there's a real push to try and deter any further movement across the Green Line of either the Greeks or the Turks. And there was a fairly strong physical presence because we not only had our bodies on the ground, we had a number of mechanized, what they call M113 armored personnel carriers brought over from Germany. And so we had a company of those, which I think was about 14. And we also had a squadron of the Lynx, which are a very similar track vehicle, but have a much powerful, they have 50 cal on the front. And that was commanded by a major. And so they stood a lot of roving patrols along the Green Line. So I think the aim was to show a strong physical presence, both mechanized and physically on the ground, to deter any movement across the Green Line by either side.
And given the lack of significant incidents that you mentioned, you figured that you were pretty successful in that regard?
Yeah, well, the Greeks pretty much collapsed, and the Turks had what they wanted. So, you know, I mean, I think probably the Turks would have made more incursions. I mean, we retook the airport because that was under Greek control, but that was done in phase one when the Greeks abandoned, the Turks abandoned the airport, and that remained in UN hands. And that was a sticking point because we deployed a lot of heavier equipment and troops around the airport because I don't know where the rule came from, but I'm assuming it came from somewhere that we've got to keep the airport. And then ultimately, the aim was to reopen the airport, which I don't recall if it was reopened or not at that point because we never flew out of there. We flew out of the British Air Base in the south called Dhekelia. Don't ask me to spell it. Dhekilia.
I'm sure I can find the spelling. All right. So with these firing orders, earlier you were talking about an incident, for example, like the Turks, I believe, setting up a mortar on your position, and you were asked to go clear it out. And you mentioned that you wouldn't really be thinking so much of the local firing orders, but you would conduct it as you normally would, as you'd been trained to do before.
I would think when you have a, you know, direct sort of a conflict at that, because I was the platoon commander in charge, I would probably just do a normal, or like a platoon assault if it had come to that. That was certainly what was going through my mind. You know, you might want to try and speak, but if they were in the process of mortaring our camp, chances are you wouldn't have an awful lot of conversation. But like I say, by the time we got there, that position had been abandoned and they had not fired any mortars into our camp.
The deterrence again. So you're obviously your motivation in terms of using your conventional tactics would be that the risk of trying to go over and talk to someone who is potentially mortaring your position is just...
Well, if they were mortaring the position, we probably wouldn't have talked.
No.
If they were just there and they appeared to be setting up something, I probably would have gone and talked to them.
Perfect. So essentially you were, in fact, going by these firing orders in terms of giving warnings.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously the aim was to deter any military action and to dissuade anybody else from doing it and to sort of lower the level of anxiety and the level of aggression so that we could keep the peace as opposed to make the peace.
Yes. Fine line. So in terms of, you said that these firing orders gave a sense of comfort to everyone, so you never heard anyone expressing any frustration at all at them at all?
Well, the only frustration I remember, and this was a long time ago, was, you know, having to yell "Dur," which I think is the Turk for stop, and "Stanata," which is a Greek, you know, like you get a bunch of soldiers, what the hell's that all about? Chances are, you know, depending on the circumstance, sure, you may want to do that. The problem is that if you don't speak their language and they don't speak yours, you might know one word, but... you know, that would sort of be the point to try and de-escalate. And by you physically being on the Green Line, chances are that would deter any activity.
Perfect.
You know, in a calm setting, I mean. Not if you probably wouldn't do that if somebody was actually, you know, in the middle of a firefight. They couldn't hear you anyway.
Screaming out and stop. So, in general, did you find that your orders and your training and these firing orders from the local CO were a positive or a negative factor?
I think they're positive because it, you know, most soldiers like rules. That's why a lot of people join the Army, because they like order, you know, like tallest on the left, shortest on the right, and single rank size. And if one thing about the Army is there are always orders, like orders go from the commanding officer to the company commanders to platoon commanders to section commanders, and then down to the soldiers. And you have to adapt the orders at that level. But it's comforting to know, here's what we do in this circumstance. Here's what we do in this situation. So the rules of engagement were really not open for discussion. That was what it was. Everybody had to know what they were, and then they just had to adapt in accordance with the rules. And if you're on your own, well, you know, you're going to make the best decision you can based on those guidelines. But it's interesting that, for example, under the rules of engagement, you can fire to protect your own personnel, including any attempt to disarm UN personnel. You can fire in defense of UN post camps or vehicles under armed attack. So that's defensive property. And I don't think that's generally what you're allowed to do in Canada, or in support of any other unit emphasis forces. So, for example, if you had someone who was attacking the Swedes or the Danes or the Austrians, then you could respond. So, for example, when there was an attack against the U.S. Embassy, one of the motor or the mechanized companies was deployed there and retook the embassy because they had a couple Marine guards there, but we had a bunch of armored carriers, and we physically rode up and took back the embassy. And I don't think any shots were fired because there was just such a strong physical presence. And that was a chap by the name of Captain Ron Bragnan who commanded that.
So in support of another company, you could go...
And we were in support of the U.S. then. The US. It wasn't really even a U.N. function. But there's another situation where I think it was Blue Beret Camp was being mortared. And the Finnish contingent were being mortared. And that same major took the armored carriers, and they actually evacuated most of the Finns in the back of the armored carriers because they just drove up, lowered the ramp, 10 or 15 Finns get in, and they took off. And so that basically, you know, was in support. But I don't think there was any shots fired. It was like, let's get out of here and let them do the thing, and then we'll deal with that later at a political or a higher level with, you know, the UN commander and the Turk. So there'd be a discussion and, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. We hit the wrong coordinates, blah, blah, blah. But the Turks didn't purposely attack UN soldiers, nor did the Greeks. They just wanted to attack each other.
Right. So I'm getting the impression, again, that it's almost as if these rules, while they were appreciated by all the soldiers in terms of laying it all out clearly, it seems almost as if you, while you were there, reacted out of your own common sense and prior training.
I think that's pretty fair to say. I mean, those rules were guidelines, and you wouldn't want to violate them or breach them, you know, purposely. But again, you have to look in the context. De-escalation was the aim, not sort of opening fire on anybody who looked like a Turk.
Of course.
So yeah, I think they were probably prudent to issue those because it gave the soldiers a sober second thought. You know, they just couldn't sort of start opening up willy-nilly. So in many ways, it was a restraint. It was probably a welcome restraint, because I don't know many soldiers who'd want to be sort of shooting people anyways, at least in that circumstance, in a UN role. So I think it gave comfort to the soldiers.
So looking back on your experience as an officer now, what is your current opinion on rules of engagement as a sort of institution in the military, in terms of how it affects a soldier's ability to do his job?
I think they're probably essential. I mean, as long as they're practical and leave some flexibility. It has to be clear. I think I recall there was some very long detailed rules of engagements, and I can't remember under what circumstances, but they have to be fairly simple. And let's face it, there's thousands of circumstances that may not actually fit right into it, so there's going to be a lot of judgment, but you have to set out the basic guideline. Don't open up first, or you may not be able to fire in defense of certain property. As long as the rules are there, clear, and they're disseminated. So, I mean, the key is to make the rules and B, disseminate them. But also the rules have to be practical. I mean, these UN ones were practical because they're done locally. If somebody at NDHQ had done these rules in isolation, I'm not sure what they would have looked like. But they probably wouldn't look a lot like this. And, it's great to follow the rules of engagement. And I guess they pretty much have to be in line with the laws of war. But you cannot have a set of rules of engagement which will cover every circumstance. You've got to have realistic and practical rules of engagements for each particular deployment. But on balance, they're great. They're essential.
Perfect. And do you have any other further comments or insights you'd like to close with?
No.
No? No overview at all?
No, I mean, let's face it, the Canadian soldiers are, pretty well educated. They're going to use their judgment. They're always, nobody wants to get into trouble or sued or charged criminally for unnecessarily opening fire. So I would think that, we're pretty lucky to have the soldiers we've got. Now, if you look back to the Turkish soldiers, I think the rules of engagement were exactly what the officer said. If the officer said fire, they fired, and they didn't stop until the officer said stop firing. There was not a lot of, as I recall, there was not a lot of independence. They were extremely tightly controlled, and you really wouldn't expect the Turk to do anything without some direction. But once given that direction, they would just blindly do it. As opposed to the Greeks, who didn't seem to have as much discipline, and they pretty much acted independently based on their own subjective beliefs, whereas I think the Canadians were far more structured. They had the general guidelines, they dealt with it as best they could, and that's probably why the Canadians were quite successful, particularly in Nicosia, because that was sort of the main sort of shooting area, so to speak, that they, exercised restraint, but on the other hand, didn't play dead. They stood up to the Greeks and the Turks and made it clear that we were there to stop either side from coming over to the other side, and if we had to, we'd use force, including deployment of our mechanized units.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for speaking to me today.